I'm Kimberly Crenshaw, and this is Intersectionality Matters, the podcast that brings intersectionality to life by exploring the hidden dimensions of today's most pressing issues. This idea travelogue lists up the work of leading activists, artists, and scholars, and helps listeners understand politics, the law, social movements, and even their own lives in deeper, more nuanced ways. Today, I have a very special guest host on Intersectionality Matters, my friend, my shero, my muse, Dina Wright Joseph. Now, Dina, in addition to being an extraordinary, talented dancer and educator, founding member of Pure Elements and Evolution in Dance, and faculty at the Ailey Fordham and Professional Performing Arts High School, she's also an artist in residence at AAPF, and she's been an integral part of our arts and activism work. Most recently, and the topic of our conversation today, she directed AAPF's Young Scholars Program this summer, and it was designed to confront what we have called the knowledge desert that exists relating to Black women and COVID. We wanted to center Black women as authorities of their own lived experience in this moment. Now, in the final days of the program, the Young Scholars sat down with Dina and with the Intersectionality Matters team to discuss the profound impact that these dual pandemics are having on their lives, in their communities, in their goals for the future. Joining us virtually from all around the country, these extraordinary young women spoke candidly about mental health, about policing, about their thoughts on returning to campus this fall, and their experiences working together this summer. We're thrilled to bring part of that conversation to you today on Intersectionality Matters. And if you'd like to listen to the full conversation, you can find it at aapf.org. So, Dina, before we dive in, I thought it might be fun to reflect on our working together over the last 5 years and how we sort of transitioned into this particular moment. What drew you into AAPF?
Well, my introduction to AAPF was very swift.
As many of these introductions have been over our history.
I committed to the summer camp before I really had a chance to be introduced to the mission of AAPF.
Now, that summer camp, Breaking the Silence, was an arts, activism, and healing summer camp for Black women and girls, and we ran it from 2015 to 2017.
Yes, so I joined the team at Vassar initially. You know, the offer was to, you know, make sure the participants are moving and energizing the participants in the day. But when I met the women, all of the brilliant participants, they were from like age 14 to
75.
Into the 60s, right, to 75, I was saying, well, number one, that's going to craft the way I'm going to create movement because, you know, our bodies move differently, you know, depending on where we are in our age range. But then also, the activism piece was so important. And I remember just sitting up the night before and being like, all right, now what am I going to do? Because this is definitely not simply about the craft of dance. Mm-hmm. I had to make sure that I chose music and movement and a theme that brought the entire community together. So it completely changed the way that I work from that moment on. And I actually took that structure and that frame, and I've continued it with my younger students.
And what is so brilliant about what you did was you chose themes each of the 3 years that we did Breaking the Silence summer camp that amplified the work that we were doing, that amplified where Black women were located, and that, as you said, allowed all of us across our age ranges to participate. We started every morning with movement, followed with meditation, and then breakfast. And it, you know what? It was a challenge too, because some folks are like, wait, I can't do anything without breakfast. I can't do anything before 10 o'clock in the morning. We're like, you know what? It's summer camp. And then after summer camp, we continued to worked together and did a few productions, including Harriet. So that's another sort of adaptation, I guess, starting from the summer camp and moving to something more discreet, but also something that was explicitly telling stories about Harriet Tubman using dance and movement and drumming and spoken word to create an immersive experience both for the participants and for the audience. Our first performance of that was in Washington, D.C.
That was Washington, D.C. Yeah, we were at the Smithsonian for the performance.
So we keep inventing and moving. So this summer presented another opportunity to invent something new. And of course, when it comes to all things artivistically oriented, I have my go-to people. And so we started thinking about what could be a way of providing a community in the face of these pandemics. How do we step into this space given the fact that we are virtual? So that, of course, became the moment that I called you up and said, Dina, we want to do something, and we want it to be in the spirit of breaking the silence. We want it to be specifically empowering by addressing what is happening right now. So that was a big sort of here, do something. So walk us through your approach to taking up this mantle and actually developing it into what is clearly, from what all the young women have been telling us, a beautiful experience.
Thank you for that. I can say walking into it was terrifying for me because, you know, I consider myself one of your get it girls, you know, like Julia and some of your other team, where it's like, you know, you just give us the idea. You know, we get it in terms of concept. You know, if we don't understand what we necessarily need to do, we get the resources, you know, and we get to work. So that's really how I approached this program. And because our scholars most of them didn't identify as artists, I had to make sure that I crafted it in a way and designed the program so that they felt comfortable being creative. And they didn't feel as if, oh, well, this is not for me, because I really came here specifically to become a researcher, you know, under the African American Policy Forum. But my initial conversation with the scholars was that, you know, it's important to be a creative, and it's important to find different ways to share information, especially with our community, because we're very... we respond well to storytelling. We respond to information that comes in ways that we can feel, as opposed to just like analytical, you know, statistics. Mm-hmm. Because that's how we experience. We experience this data day to day, but to be able to organize it and share it in a way that multiple audiences can understand, you know, it was really very, very important. And for that, I just felt like we had to really tap into our creativity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What can you share with folks about what resonated with the young women from the conversations that you had, and why was it important to come together during COVID?
For one, as you know, you picked the top minds, you know, in terms of the young scholars who applied for the program. I mean, they're just like off the charts brilliant. So they all felt really confident in their academic achievement and their ability. But what I realized pretty quickly was that they had never really had community, because a lot of times, because they were, you know, academically advanced, they didn't find community in their schools. So then when they were moved into gifted and talented programs or into different types of magnet schools, then they found that they were in predominantly white institutions, and then they didn't feel community there. Mm. So most of them actually came into the program not even realizing that that's something they really needed. So pretty quickly, I was able to see, like, within the first week, that that was really the gem, that they really needed each other, and they needed a safe space where, you know, conversation started to shift from how the way they usually presented themselves, which was, you know, as intellectuals, but then started to shift into, you know, just some of their own needs as young Black women. And I realized that as much as I tried to create a schedule, mm-hmm. that this was just as important.
Yes. You know,
that they had each other. And also, they were all in some interesting positions because they're all in undergrad, but they were living on campus. Mm-hmm. So for some, they had in their minds, they'd graduated beyond living at home with their parents mm-hmm. and started to create this life of independence. And then very quickly, very abruptly, they had to go back home. And their parents picked up from where they were, you know, before they moved out. So they felt that they'd outgrown their living environment, and they didn't really have a way to articulate the need to transition their relationships with their parents.
And probably something happening across, you know, young people everywhere. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, we have a clip that actually speaks precisely to that. This is Aaron and Mia speaking.
I've had a lot of friends personally who were not able to seek mental health resources, either due to economics, or maybe their parents didn't believe in it, or maybe it was just not something that was discussed in the house. And so until they got to college, they didn't have the resources, they didn't have the opportunity. And then they got there and they started to pursue them. They started engaging in therapy and they started engaging in meditation and mindfulness. So it's interesting to think of the ways in which COVID has kind of set some people back. You know, me personally, I feel like I was an adult when I was at college, and I felt so independent that I had control of everything. And coming back home was kind of hard because, you know, I no longer get to decide how the dishes are put in the dishwasher. I no longer get to decide like what colors the wall are or how I move throughout the house when I'm going in and out. And so I felt kind of a lack of independence, and I feel like I'm stepping back. I'm taking a step back during this time.
It's really important to think about the impact of the home on mental health. During my time with you guys, I found through my research that the mental health stigma that the Black community has can be traced back to slavery. And it was thought that enslaved people weren't sophisticated enough to develop mental illnesses, and Black people were basically taught to ignore their mental health issues and refer to them as other names, which were basically euphemisms like just being stressed or just being tired.
Dina, what was a typical day in the program like?
Well, we always started our first hour with what we called our check-in. And that was really just anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour where each of the scholars, and they would even ask me, you know, like, where were they? Where are they, you know, how were they feeling? What were they needing? You know, what bothered them or what made them happy? And then we started to actually show, you know, all of the snacks that we prepared. We was like, okay, I have my tea and I have my watermelon. I have my, you know, so that became a part of the day where we started creating rituals to come together. Then on our Mondays and Thursdays, we had sessions with Dr. Venus Evans Winters. And she was our advisor who actually taught the scholars the actual nuts and bolts of becoming researchers.
So from the rituals, which sounds very much like the rituals that we wanted to establish, right, when we were together physically, but then to the information sharing. So who are some of the people who came in, and what were some of the things that the scholars were able to learn from the wonderful list of people that you had lined up?
We had Dr. Akisi Britton, we had Dr. Maisha Taylor, Dr. Arabia Mollett, Dr. Cindy Duke, Shaka Legear, who is the first Caribbean woman to become a clerk in the International Court, as well as Camille A. Brown, who is a Tony-winning, Emmy-winning choreographer and a great friend of mine as well. And the scholars had a chance to listen to them, to talk with them. The speakers wanted to make sure that they spoke specifically to COVID, to the effects of Black women and girls, and to education. So our Black physicians didn't only speak about their work on the front lines, but also what were their challenges of becoming Black girls who wanted to become a physician. So they were able to speak from so many different angles. And, you know, they were able to just be very, very candid, which was really a real treat.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, Dina, a lot of them actually had parents working in the healthcare industry, those who were on the front lines in hospitals and nursing homes when COVID first hit. So Haley Starr and Junia each spoke to this. So let's listen to what they have to say.
She has to come home and she has to stay away from her family, and she goes straight to the shower and she strips naked and gets put the clothes that she wore in a separate pile. And she has to, we can't even after the shower, even after she's perfectly clean, every time we're about to give her a kiss, her husband's like, stay out of my face. And it's like, you know, it's something that you're constantly reminded, where if your family doesn't have a frontline worker, it's not something that you're necessarily constantly reminded about. Like, not only is it the thought of like, oh, you can't even hug your own mother now, you know, it's something that is already a big enough weight on the family dynamic. But then you're also constantly reminded that your mom could be sick with COVID, which is deadly, and she could die. Constantly. Constantly reminded. Anytime you want to give your mom a kiss goodnight, you're constantly reminded of this toll that's taking on the family dynamic. And it's necessary. We need frontline workers. We need essential workers. And it's amazing what they do. These are the leaders. These are the world changers. These are the people that we need in society that have such a big heart. And so I look at my mom and I'm very proud of her. I obviously am nervous for her, but I don't think I've ever really thought like, man, I wish she wasn't an ER doctor, because her being an ER doctor is one of the many factors that make her. And it's not something that I would want to change.
My mom also works in a healthcare facility on a case management team, and she was exposed to COVID during her first week back in the office. And as a Black woman working during this pandemic, I think that the state health system made it pretty clear that productivity was their priority. So they're not necessarily concerned about the safety and health of their workers who are typically Black women. And I think that many Black female healthcare workers are being treated as if they're disposable, and no one necessarily cares about their well-being or their family's well-being.
No, I definitely agree with that, Star, especially about like the idea of being like disposable. And I think sometimes too, it's like within the states, like they're just not allocating resources to a lot of these healthcare facilities. They're just not getting support. And like support also meaning like support for patients who do have it as well as workers, but also just like having emotional support and actually being able to like help people mentally during this time. Cause it is challenging when you're seeing patients or people that you've worked with going through it. And so like for my mom, for example, she's a nursing assistant. And so she works at two different nursing homes. And so she ended up working in a COVID wing. And so she really cares about her patients. And like a lot of her patients did end up getting sick. She was at one of the first places that contracted the most cases. And so she ended up testing positive within a week. But what was hard the most was her experience, of course, testing positive, but also before that, having her go to work every day and come back with another story of like, here's what happened at work and I couldn't help this person the way I wanted to. And so I saw how much of a big impact it made on my mom, and just like the fact that there's no real support system. Like, I mean, there is at home, but she's not really getting that outside of work.
So insightful and so powerful at the same time. You know, in our Under the Blacklight series, we talked early on about the contradiction that so many Black women found themselves in, that they were seen as and framed as essential workers, which meant that they were expected to be at work doing their jobs. But at the same time, that essential designation didn't mean that they were valued, right? In other words, they were also dealing with being disposable, you know, so the tension between being essential and disposable was something that we saw in the data, but listening to the young scholars, we are seeing them see that. We're seeing them confront that. What do you think it meant for them to be able to talk about this and share their reactions and their observations collectively?
I think it meant so much to them because, similar to what I said before, like they really needed community. And they would often say that even if they had a very difficult evening or difficult morning, they would always say they look forward to coming together with their sisters. So for 4.5 hours to 5 hours a day, they knew that I would be there. They knew that they would have an opportunity to speak about how they felt that day, that they would get responses from their sisters, and we would work collectively as a group.
Yeah. So, Dina, in holding space for them, you yourself revealed something quite personal. You want to talk about that?
You know, I witnessed COVID firsthand in some pretty brutal ways. My daughter is a young actor, and we were in California for about 6 months working on a television series. And as COVID was moving from the East over to the West in Europe, and then it was making its way to the United States, we were all kind of bracing ourselves. And eventually production and everything, you know, shut down, schools were closed, and we were flown quickly from California back to New York where we live. My goal was to just buckle down at home, and, you know, my husband and I would do grocery shopping, and we would just all, like, you know, be together. And we live in a mother-daughter home, which is a two-family home with one entrance. My mom and brother live upstairs. My family, my husband and children live downstairs. And when I got home, I saw my mom and my brother. We arrived on Monday. They looked like themselves. Everything was great. But by Tuesday, it was apparent that COVID had already taken place and, you know, had taken shape with them. And it was like their health was just downhill from there. So by Saturday, I had to take my brother to the emergency room. I had to call the EMS, actually, because I thought he'd had a stroke because COVID affected him neurologically. And then by Sunday, the following day, I had to take my mom to the emergency room because she'd spiked a fever, and she by this time, we were just learning about the acute symptoms of COVID, and they were both showing them. So, you know, we had to take my mom to the emergency room, and, you know, having them in separate hospitals meant I had to, you know, make calls constantly twice a day. And now family knows and they can't get to us. So it was my job to report to family every day. And of course, you know, my anxiety built up, you know, in a way that I'd never experienced before. But unfortunately, my mom did not make it. She was in the hospital for 10 days. But my brother did survive. He's well now, but he was in the hospital for 4 weeks, and then he wasn't strong enough to come home. So then we had to move him to a rehab facility, a nursing and rehab facility, for an additional 3 weeks. Now, also, while this was happening, my husband and I also started showing COVID symptoms. So, you know, trying our best not to panic our children, we just really tried to very calmly, you know, take care of ourselves, take care of each other, you know, isolate when fevers came up. And, you know, luckily we were like super health conscious, and we were doing the vitamin C, everything that we learned about vitamin C, the vitamin D or oregano oil, we were doing that. We were only cooking food at home just to make sure absolutely no dairy. So we were just really leaning on keeping our diet very simple.
You're grieving the loss of your mom. You are supporting your brother. You're being the source of information for the rest of the family. And you're also battling the disease yourselves.
Exactly. Exactly. So it was quite a time from March to April.
Yeah. And it was March, right? So you all went through this tragedy in the earliest weeks of it, when folks didn't know what to expect. There wasn't a strong sense of what was happening, not even really enough information fully about how to protect themselves. So in many ways, your family is at the you know, sort of the definition of what could have been prevented had more information been available earlier, if this had been taken more seriously, if people, you know, had realized that, you know, this is real and it's going to happen. It's not a flu. It's not a little bug. It is, you know, absolutely devastating if we don't really have the tools necessary to protect ourselves. So with your own experience then, holding this space for young women, first of all, I just want to thank you for being willing to hold space for them, given what you were dealing with yourself. What is it that you think you modeled for these young women in being able to tell this story and still be able to hold space and lift up the need to share information?
First of all, I actually didn't share my story with the scholars because I didn't want to shift the way they saw me or experienced me. I didn't actually tell them the story until we pretty much finished the program. But saving space for the scholars was about as healing for me as it was for them as well. Because as you said, you know, losing my mom when we were really at the height of how it was affecting New York City in particular was terrifying because we didn't have information. So being a part of a program where we're literally finding this data and holding this data from the voices of Black women, where they're not just the subjects of research, but they're actually the researchers, was really very healing.
Yeah. Well, you know, and you mentioned then the way that this drives a couple aspects of the project. One was oral history projects, talking to, you know, our elders, and you facilitated that as well. What was that like?
That was a beautiful experience. Dr. Venus prepared them so well to interview these elders. Every one of them had a different approach, but just their ability to tell their stories was just magnificent. I really learned so much from every one of them. I mean, just brilliant, confident, strong. They all had their own ideology around their Blackness. Mm-hmm. I mean, every one of them were just so clear.
And what do you think the value of the intergenerational dialogue actually was for these young women?
It was powerful. It was so necessary because a lot of our young people, they really only get a chance to really speak with their parents. And, you know, their parents are still operating in a mode of, you know, I'm teaching you the steps that you need to be successful in life. They haven't gotten a chance to really just relax and tell their stories. Mm. This project actually got me to, I started to interview my aunt, my mom's sister. Mm. And the stories I got about my family, I was like, mind was blown.
So things you didn't know.
Ooh, there were things yeah. I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, and we ended up just laughing. She actually told me things that she'd never told anyone.
Wow.
So at some point she's now, you know, she sees me as an adult and she's able to tell me, you know, some of her own like personal stories.
Well, you know, and you mentioned then the way that this drives a couple aspects of the project. One was when I thought about just this whole generation who are particularly at risk, I thought, how can we hold them up so that the life force that they have been and the experiences that they bring to the fore as Black people, many who were born and raised before the modern civil rights movement, if we're not able to hold their light, then our ability to understand the world we live in is diminished by that. Some of the information that we currently have about what it was like to actually be a slave happened during the period of time when the federal government was actually paying researchers to collect this information. And had they not done it, much of our understanding of our own history would have been lost. So they were able to actually interview older African Americans who had been born into slavery, who had firsthand information, but one had to take seriously the need to record, to curate, to hold of these stories of survival. So this seemed to me to be another moment where we really needed to take stock. We need to realize that the generation that survived and struggled during segregation is a generation that we are beginning to lose, even more so now that we see the consequences of COVID. So we both wanted to gather those stories, and we wanted to signal the importance of their lives.
So my group, we were called the Supernova Group, and we did isolation, you know, social isolation leading to criminality in Black girls, and just understanding more how it feels to be socially isolated and why maybe acting out is a path that some kids choose. It was really interesting to have these conversations with girls that I could see myself as. I was looking at this girl and I was like, I was you 3 years ago, like not that long ago. I very much can still remember being you. And so it was very interesting to, and it was really nice actually to be able to give her advice and to try and give her the things that I wish I had known, you know, like, hey, baby girl, by the way, like, it was a really nice experience. And I think it was for her too. And it was nice to feel like I was doing something of importance. In logging her story, I was adding something important and needed to the database.
It felt like a normal conversation. Like, I'm just talking with this girl, like Mia said, who I could have been and I was in the past, but then also to realize that this is like actual important research. Like, this is stuff that people need to know and people need to hear, but it's also stuff that she needed to hear and like to support and reinforce her, because I know the person I interviewed wants to go into the healthcare field, and it's so important to have Black women in healthcare. And so to reinforce her and to tell her, like, your dreams are important because your work is so important. You're going to save so many lives. Like, I just think that that's something that I wish I heard.
I wasn't in the Supernova group, but I was in Young Goddess Collective, shout out. But it was definitely like Dr. Venus, she mentioned just in the beginning of this entire process, like, who is the researcher and who is researched? And like, with us being the group that is constantly researched through the white gaze, finally being able to like conduct that with our own agency and knowing how to create that comfortable environment where we're not just onlookers, like, we share these experiences, like, that was something that I've never really gotten to conduct interviews like that. And for that to be my first experience was something that was really powerful for me.
I don't know if anyone's ever had like government officials like come into your school and they like watch your teachers and they watch you and they're like in the back of the room and you feel like, I don't know, you feel like you're in a petri dish and you like are constantly like on edge, like what's going on. And like, that's what I normally associate with like research interviews, like protocols. It just feels very like, I'm gonna sit in the back and like watch you and take down the notes. But this was like a really nice experience where it could feel like not transactional, but like we were both getting something out of it. And it wasn't just like we're both getting knowledge, but like we're both getting the opportunity to like feel heard and seen. They get to tell me their story and I am constantly hearing myself in your story. And like, so in the back of my mind, I'm like, yeah, me too. Like, I don't know. It's just, it could feel like community for like the small moments that we were together in those interviews.
So Dina, who were these interviewees that the young women were talking about?
So each research team had different criteria in terms of who they were going to interview. The age range was probably from 12 to 75.
And I noticed they had little names for the groups. What were these names and how'd they come up with them?
So we had 12 scholars, so we broke them up into four groups of three. And they came up with their names, and they even designed like these little logos for each of their research teams. Young Goddess Collective, Supernova, AAPF's Most Wanted.
I love it. I loved it. So what did they talk about in terms of on-campus issues? I understand that there was a conversation about campus policing.
Yes. The scholars were saying that even pre-COVID, pre-racial uprisings, they were observing that campus police was a little more aggressive, a little more present, especially when it came to dorms that were populated with, you know, the small number of Black students that they had. They were saying that very often they felt that administration didn't listen to them. They kind of always felt like they had to, like, advocate for themselves as the Black students on campuses. And they had to almost create their own coalitions within the predominantly white institutions that many of them attend. So what they were concerned about was most of the schools were planning to open fully on campus at the top of this semester, this fall semester. They were just concerned about how campus police was going to enforce social distancing. They already knew that they had a lot of classmates who were going to push the barriers, who were going to choose to come together, party. They understood their population. They understood, you know, who their peers were. What I recognize in a very, very short amount of time is how social distancing can be weaponized. You know, so as a Black body standing in space, if someone else wants you to move, then they can come close to you, and then your response should be to move further away. You'll find yourself adjusting more than ever to try to socially distance, but at the same time, it's like, you know, are we really socially distancing, or are you just really moving me out of the way and pushing me to the periphery?
Which is not unprecedented, right? For the way, you know, our bodies in space have prompted often white reaction to move us. Well, let's hear what they had to say about campus policing.
On Stanford's campus, the Black community is highly concentrated on West Campus. And so that has tended to be over-policed. And so I fear with the need to regulate and enforce social distancing guidelines, I do think it's a bit scary to see like what that would look like for Black students on campus.
I definitely understand that fear, Gabby. I know for our school, we also have Black dorms, and we also have dorms for students of color. And you find that those are the dorms that are policed heavily by our public safety. And it took our students coming up with a Bill of Rights and actually having to sit down with the head of public safety in order to change that dynamic. And it's like, that's not a student's job, that's administration's job, especially when administration is saying they're in support of Black Lives Matter. You can't just see it, you actually have to own up to it.
I 100% agree. Like, they need to own up to it. And like for us in Boston, the Boston Police Department is in conjunction with most campus police. So like BU, Northeastern, and other schools as well, they have like their campus police are pretty much like they're indistinguishable from the actual Boston police. And so I remember we were protesting. It was a group of Black students primarily. And I was like, anyone who's been to a protest knows like usually you're in the middle of the street, but we're on the sidewalk. And so you just see like police helicopters. There's like police on bikes, which is like, I don't know why, like just a whole bunch of unnecessary things. And it was just a show of force. Like, it's not like a matter of safety. It's just like, let's show you how strong we can be.
So that was Gabby, Anaya, and Junya. I mean, it really does remind us that the policing problem isn't one that we can perform our way out of. Just being students, just being, you know, in Black dorms or being Black bodies in any dorms, those are all triggers for a particular kind of response. I mean, I'm on UCLA. I've been policed coming out of my office. So the fact that our young scholars experience it, see it, and it is one of the concerns that they have going back to school, it's just another moment of a racial burden that I'm sure, you know, most white students aren't really thinking about when they're thinking about navigating COVID. Did young scholars have a sense, or had they come to a point where they were able to say why it's absolutely important that these experiences and that their research actually happen and be part of a wider national conversation about the twin pandemics?
They did. they were inspired to not only become researchers, but they wanted to learn more about legislation, which will most likely be part two of their program. They want to write a legislative letter. They want to make sure that the information doesn't stop with them. And it doesn't only live in the world of academia. They want to make sure that everyone is going to benefit from taking the time to compile this data and try to create a sense of, okay, what is next? What needs to be done? We can prove that this has been a very specific issue and we need very specific results.
And they spoke about at the end the impact that this summer program has had on them, and in particular, the importance of carving out space for Black girls, especially in the midst of these dual pandemics. So let's hear a little bit about the reflections on the Young Scholars Program.
For me personally, like during this time, a lot of truth has arisen, has come to the surface about my friends, some of their beliefs, some of their biases, which have been like kind of painful personally for me. I grew up in like a predominantly white area, so a lot of my friends at home are white. And so it was hard talking to them during all this and being like, yo, like I love you guys, but like some of your opinions are whack. And so it was really nice to be in this space because I didn't feel like I had to prove my worth ever. Like when we were talking about things, it was never like, but the economy. And I'm like, bro, who cares about the economy? I don't want to die. I don't care about like, you know, like if it's economy or my life, like I'm choosing my life, and the fact that you're not choosing my life, kind of hurtful. Like I think for a lot of non-people of color, it kind of feels like an opinion because their lives aren't on the line. But like for us, it's not an opinion. So I've really enjoyed this particular internship during this time because I think it was kind of like a godsend for me personally.
Yeah, to like jump off of that in terms of like growing up in a predominantly white area and predominantly white settings, but I feel like what's different for me is because of that, I'm really used to just like finding a group of Black people and like we sit in a room together and we vent when something happens, when there's like a racially charged incident. And because of quarantine and COVID, like I haven't been able to like get in a room with just like a lot of Black girls and like talk about what's going on. And so like our morning check-ins and like our somewhat unproductive tangents have really like been that replacement for me and been like really helpful for being able to like get into like the real nuance of situations. Cause like I've had meetings with professors who like, before we talk about my paper, they're like very clunkily, like, I know there's like a lot going on in the world. And it's like, I don't really, I don't want to talk to you about this. I want you to tell me like the responses on my paper. And then I will go talk to this with people I'm comfortable with. And like, this has been a place that I actually really feel comfortable talking about those things.
Even though I go to an HBCU, and even though there's a lot of women that go to my HBCU, a lot of like the perspectives that I hear from is from the Black male perspective. And like my closest friends, most of them are Black males. And so I never had a chance to build a healthy sisterhood with just like women who, young Black women who understand me. Just like this group, they check off every like thing that fulfills me, whether it's the intellectual side, the more emotional and self-care side, literally everything. They're funny, they're smart, they're beautiful, and they're just so nice. And it feels like we built a sisterhood, a family. And Miss Dina is like the big sister slash mom you always wanted to have too. And so, you know, I really am grateful.
I've never been in the like group of Black women like you guys. And it's just like, I think a really big thing for me is that like, I thought I was chilling before, but like now I really wasn't. Like I was down and now y'all brought me up, you know, like I grew so much from this group and I feel so lucky like being around all of you guys. Like, yes, you guys are hilarious, beautiful, so smart, but not in the way where it's like, dang, I'm dumb. Like we're smart together and we uplift each other. Like there's never been a moment where I'm like, do I belong? Like, I don't know. Like, no, we're all here together to grow and to keep going. And like, this is sisterhood.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, before this internship, like, I didn't have a lot of, like, female friends. Like, I didn't have female friends at all because, like, usually girls would always exclude me and, like, make me feel less than I already am. And, like, being part of this group makes me feel like I'm a part of a big family. And I'll definitely ride for all y'all. And, like, I know that you guys would definitely ride for me, too. This is a relationship for, like, life, and I'm just glad to be part of the sisterhood.
Y'all have me like crybaby central. Oh my god. First of all, shout out to Ms. Dina. I've been meaning to tell you this since like the first day. Your smile probably could cure every illness. Whenever you smile, I'm like, thank you, because that's exactly what I needed. But yeah, thank you all for like allowing me to be a part of everything with you. And yeah, big love.
Mia, Carly, Kasaya, Kayla, Kimberly, Aaron. And it sounds like your family has just now grown.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
This is definitely, you know, proof of that saying, it takes a village, right? If it takes a village to raise a child in the best of circumstances, what does it take in the middle of twin pandemics? There was space to be filled, space to be held, and families of choice seem to have grown out of it.
I think the most important thing is that we gave 12 young scholars the opportunity to take their own voices seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, they realize that they really do have a lot to offer, that they aren't working, you know, in isolation, that as much as they feel like unicorns, that they are part of a society of unicorns, and what can happen when they do work together and they do allow themselves to be vulnerable in front of each other, mm-hmm. and support each other as sisters as well as academics.
Mm-hmm. So already we're seeing our young scholars thrive and going out and really, you know, being beacons for other Black women and girls. So I'm really excited about this. I look forward to not only seeing what this generation does, but seeing the program grow. I hope, Dina Wright Joseph, that it grows with you. We'll be able to have you back. Yes.
Definitely.
Wonderful. And I also want to take the opportunity to thank the grant makers for Girls of Color who made this program possible, and also Dr. Venus Evans Winters, who brought so much of her knowledge and experience to this program to make it possible. And thanks finally to the wonderful sisters, the wonderful young women of AAPF's first Young Scholars Program. Thanks, Dina, for joining us.
Thank you.
Intersectionality Matters is produced by Julia Sharp Levine. This episode was co-produced and edited by Alexandra Moore and Whitney Thomas. The conversation in today's episode was crafted and curated by Dina Wright Joseph and AAPF's Young Scholars Program. More information on the voices behind today's episode can be found in the episode notes. You can support us by leaving a review on iTunes, following us on social media, and signing up for our Patreon page. Intersectionality Matters is supported by you, our listeners. If you value conversations like these, consider donating at aapf.org. I'm your host, Kimberly Crenshaw, and this is Intersectionality Matters.
Louis Scarcella was the greatest homicide detective of his generation.
I am the protector of these people. I am the guardian that they need.
Derek Hamilton was the best jailhouse lawyer of his.
And the law was my girlfriend. It was all I had.
What happens when a group of convicted felons take on the cop who put them away?
We gotta attack Scarcella.
Come and get me.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.